Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm the magazine's editor, Janet Hutchings. Late last month, EQMM received the news that a story by Louisiana writer O'Neill Deneau, which appeared in our September-October 2019 issue, had won the Private Eye Writers of America's most recent Seamus Award for Best Short Story. The author also won the 2007 Seamus for Best Short Story and has claimed the Short Mystery Fiction Society's Derringer Award for Best Novelette in the past. Though he is clearly distinguished in short fiction, O'Neill Deneau is also the author of more than 30 novels, including five in the series to which this year's Seamus-winning story belongs, starring Private Eye Lucien Kay. Here is O'Neill Deneau reading his 2020 Seamus Award-winning story, Sakale Man.
Late afternoon sunlight shimmers on the row of windows lining the wall of my office. Orange light bathing the oaks and magnolia trees of Cabrini Playground across narrow Barrack Street. A cool breeze brings in the scent of freshly cut grass through the open transoms above two of the windows. I put my feet up on my desk, lean back in the captain's chair, and close my eyes, thinking about what I'll have for supper when I go upstairs to my apartment. Another ham and cheese sandwich, and the phone rings, and I pull my legs down, answer after the third ring. Is this Lucien Kay? A male voice. Yes, it is. Lucien, don't know if you remember me, but we went to Holy Cross together, Sam Merthin. Oh, yeah, I remember. Baseball team, right? Right, I need your help. I pull my notebook and ballpoint from my desk drawer. A man called earlier, said he'd kidnapped my son and he would call back at 7 p.m. We have two sons and both are upstairs with bad colds. I call the police and they think it's a crank call. Can you come over? He gives me an address on Sherwood Forest Drive in Mid-City. I tell him, sure, I'll be right over. I'll grab my suitcase on the way out to my 1940 DeSoto, 8 years old this month, pause to take in the warm early evening of the old French Quarter, while lace-rake balconies lean from 200 years of human weight, masonry peeling from cypress between brick buildings. A half hour later, I pull up in front of a three-story, pale yellow mansion, one house up Sherwood Forest from City Park Avenue and the wide expanse of City Park. I park in the wide driveway behind a cream-colored 48 four-door Cadillac and a sleek ruby-red 38 Talbot Lego. I pause to study the Lego's curved lines. The front door opens as I step up, and it takes a moment for me to realize the bulky man in the doorway is Sam Merthin in a brown suit, red tie loosened. A pretty full-bodied blonde woman in a dark green dress stands behind him. Sam extends his hand. Honey, this is the Rocket, fastest halfback on the Holy Cross Tiger City champion team. Ran the 80-yard winning touchdown against Jesuit in the rain. We shake hands. From the all-state shortstop we call the Steeler, I say. Set a state record of stolen bases, didn't you? He pats his belly. 60 pounds and a dozen years ago. The sound of car brakes turns me around as two black New Orleans police prowl cars pull up across the street. I scratch through the white star and crescent badge on the front door of the first car, Mars the emblem. Two cops I don't know get out and head to a pale green mansion on the other side of the street. Sergeant Ray Simone gets out of his second car, stretches, and follows the other two toward the pale green three-story mansion. You called the police earlier, didn't you? Yes, but I'll be right back. I step away, cut my hands around my mouth, and call out to Ray. He looks over his shoulder, sees me, opens his arms, hands, palms up. I hustle over, and he comes back toward his car to meet me. What's up, Luce? Ray and I rode together when I was the police before the war. I tell him about the phone call across the street. He goes, we got a missing kid over here. I look back at Sam and his wife, then turn back to Ray. Maybe the caller called the wrong house? Ray tells me he'll check here and come over in a few. I go back across the street. Sam lets me into a bright foyer with a reddish-brown marble floor and a wide spiral staircase. Large blue vases on white pedestals, all paintings of forests and wheat fields, the large chandelier above. The room smells of lemon. Looks like a library off to the left and a living room to the right where they lead me. His wife's name turns out to be Honey. They have two boys upstairs, 6-year-old Edward and 4-year-old Alvin. Their nanny is with them. I tell them what Ray said, and we settle in the living room with two sofas, a love seat, and two thick easy chairs, a thick tan carpet, and a huge fireplace. That house across the street, Sam says, they have a boy named Eddie. Same age as ours, Honey adds, has blonde hair like our boys. She puts a hand to her throat. Eddie Amable. He came here just before noon today. Asked if our Eddie could come out and play. And I told him our Eddie was still sick. Sam tells Honey he answered the phone before 4 o'clock. A man with a deep voice said, I have your son. I'll call back at 7 p.m. with instructions, and hung up. Deep voice? Yes, raspy. Hear anything in the background? Honey shakes her head. I look at the grandfather clock, 2 minutes until 6 p.m. We want you to listen on an extension if he calls back. I nod. We agree to whatever he says and go from there. Okay, your nanny. How long has she been with you? Since Edward was born, Honey answers. She's my cousin, Rachel, retired librarian. Sweetest woman. I'll talk with her after the call. I look at the clock again. It's 6 o'clock. Been following your career, Sam says. In the papers. Catching that public enemy guy. And that gun girl. I ask what Sam's been up to. First Fidelity Bank. Vice President of Operations. His voice deepens. I suppose he's in business mode now. You have anything to do with hiring and firing? Sam looks confused for a moment. Not directly. Any recent disgruntled employees? Eyes light up. The doorbell rings and we all jump. I introduce Sam to Sergeant Ray Simone and he looks at his notebook. Saturdays. Ray shakes his head and says, Edward Amable, age 6, was supposed to play in the backyard, maybe out front. He looks over his shoulder. Kids aren't supposed to leave the neighborhood, Honey says, but the Eddies sneak across the avenue to play in the park. Eddies? Goes Ray. Honey explains about her son, then tells him how Eddie Amable came by before noon. Ray goes back to his notes. He's in a gray t-shirt and blue jeans, black tennis shoes. We're canvassing all the houses around here and have men in the park, so. What's this about a phone call? 2 cups of semi-strong cafe au lait later, Ray sits on the other side of the phone from Honey at 7 p.m. He runs a hand through his thinning hair. The plan is for Honey to pretend the stolen boy is hers and see what the caller wants. A woman in her 50s peeks in and I ask if she's Rachel. She stiffens and says, yes. Have any strangers come around the house lately? Strangers? She shakes her head. Anyone knocking on the door asking an innocuous question, like directions? No. She asks Honey if she wants to put the children to sleep. They're still playing with the train set. Honey tells her in a little while, and Rachel steps back out the door, comes right back in, and looks at me. A man asked for a drink from the hose day before yesterday in the afternoon. No, it was Wednesday. He was passing along the street while I watered the roses. I pull out my notebook and jot down the man's description. So does Ray. White male, same height as Sam, which is 5'9", thin sandy hair, wearing green overalls. Nice looking fellow. Rachel touches her face, except for the marks on his face, pock marks, dots. Asked if the Josephsons still lived here. I told him I never heard of the Josephsons. Did you tell him who lives here now? Her hand goes to her throat, and she looks at Honey and nods slowly. I told him this was the Merthin residence. She's about to cry. Anything else? She looks at her shoes. Rachel in a long plaid dress and sensible thick black shoes. He asked William Merthin, and I said, no, Samuel Merthin. Did he have a deep voice? Her eyes narrow. Deeper than mine, I ask. Maybe a little raspy? She nods slowly. When he walked away, which way did he go? Toward the park. See any car? No. She wipes her eyes, and I nod. Tell her if she thinks of anything else, be sure to tell us. She looks down and leaves. You think that was the caller? Sam asks. I hope so. She got a good look at him. She'll be able to identify him. At 8, Honey goes up to put her kids to sleep, and my stomach burns from too much coffee and no food. Just as Honey comes down, the doorbell rings again, and Ray and I follow Honey and Sam, who opens the door to the one person I did not want to see. Lieutenant Frenchy Copperfield drops his cigarette outside and steps on it, asks Ray if the call came. Behind Frenchy stands Detective Al Francona, with a weary look on his pretty boy Italian face. Nope. Frenchy runs his hands through his thick, curly black hair. The man's a dead ringer for Zorro, even without a cape. He pulls his ID folder from an interior pocket of his well-worn suit coat. I'm Lieutenant Copperfield. He nods over his shoulder. If it's okay, I'll leave Detective Francona here in case the call comes in late. Frenchy waves for Ray to come along. Frenchy finally sees me behind everyone, and his shoulders sink. You again? His lip curls in a snarl, and he turns away with Ray, and Francona comes in. He doesn't like you, does he? Sam says. Francona corrects him. The lieutenant's teasing. He's Lucian's big brother, more or less. Taught me everything I know, I say. The ache in my stomach mushrooms. Honey notices my face and asks, what's happened? Francona's voice softens. We found the boy. The dark brown eyes are void of expression, and Honey turns back to me, says in an asking voice, they found him? She sees him trying to hide it. These are homicide detectives. I let the words sink in, and Sam's sharp enough to take his wife's elbow as her eyes fill with tears, and she slumps against him. Just after 10 p.m., Sam asked me into a home office of mahogany bookshelves filled with heavy books. I catch words on the spines, stocks, bonds, investing, a line of Hemingway's and a bright red volume, Das Kapital. I know what that's about. He plops in a high back chair behind a desk that's even bigger than mine and waves to the thick cushioned chairs in front of his desk. Sam leans back and closes his eyes. Eddie Amable was my son's best friend. They've been spending nights at each other's houses since they were 4. How the hell do I tell him he'll never see Eddie again? He comes out of it a few moments later, pulls out a large checkbook, and starts filling out a check. What are your rates? I tell him $30 a day plus expenses. I'd like to engage you for the next few weeks or until the police clear this up. Sure. He signs a check, tears it from the checkbook, and slides it across to me. It's for $1,000. Damn, all right. In the morning, we'll take the boys to my parents in Bay St. Louis for at least a week. Honey will stay with them. If the caller calls back during the day, Rachel can answer and I'll be here in the evening. If the police haven't cleared up this matter in a week, if we don't know who called us, I want you to escort my Eddie to school. Holy Cross. I'll introduce you to the principal, mother, superior, and Edward's teacher. I'd like you to hang around the school, especially at recess. Edward's in first grade. He rubs his eyes. Same as Eddie Amable. Recess for them is behind the school along Moss Street and Bayou St. John. The nuns sometimes take them a block up Esplanade to Desmarais Playground. You could drive Edward to and from school, okay? Sure. He leans back in his chair, looks at the ceiling. I tell him, when I ask about disgruntled employees, you had a reaction. He nods. Former employee, teller with a temper, fired for arguing with a customer over change, nickels and dimes. He didn't threaten anyone exactly. He just shook his fist and yelled, one day, one day. Sam shivers. Big guy. Real big guy. Name not easy to forget. Leontine Gallup. Lives on Bell Street. He fixes his eyes on mine. I remember it because it's close, right off Moss and the Bayou. Near Holy Cross School. I've got goosebumps now. I take out my notebook, ask for the address and phone number in Bay St. Louis, where they'll be staying. I make it home before the rain and fix 2 hams and cheese sandwiches, downing them with a couple of Falstaffs, as I watch the rain wash across the roofs of the old quarter. Tomorrow I'll find out what the police know about this little dead boy. Damn. I park my DeSoto next to the dozen NOPD prowl cars parked near the concrete Greek peristyle in City Park. Pigeons flutter from under the open peristyle's tall roof. Three cops in uniform stand looking at the lagoon on the far side of the peristyle. I move past them. One calls out, "Hey, no reporters." Frenchie Copleyville turns from the water, sees me, and waves me over. I take the cement steps past one of the 12-foot stone lions to the water's edge. Two detectives slowly walk next to the water, both looking down. Frenchie fires up another lucky strike, looks over his shoulder at the tall peristyle. "Ever count the columns?" 32 Ionic columns, I tell him. Counted them when I was a kid. He looks back at the lagoon's dark brown water lying flat and still. "He was found here?" Frenchie shakes his head, points to a nearby brick cubicle with a concrete roof. "Women's bathroom. He was killed elsewhere, strangled, dumped here in a burlap sack." "Women's bathroom?" It takes a few seconds for me to realize. If you're going to stash a body in a public bathroom, use the ladies. Few women use these old funky bathrooms where a man would take a leak anywhere. Might have been days before the body was found if the cops weren't looking for the boy. Got some trace evidence from the sack. Mud and rust. Rust? And the sack had oranges stenciled on it. Smells like oranges inside. I wave away Frenchie's cigarette smoke and he huffs. Tells me they posted the boy this morning. On a Sunday. Unusual. But this was a child. His father's a doctor. Chief of staff at EENT Hospital. Every time I hear the initials, I have to run it through my mind. EENT. Eyes, ears, nose, and throat. I catch a whiff of stagnant water smelling like mildew. A snowy egret about 2 feet tall lands in the shallows across the lagoon. Strangled. Frenchie holds up his hands by large hands. No evidence he was molested. Both shoes missing. U.S. Keds high top tennis shoes. Special red edition. I glance around. "We've been canvassing since last night," he shakes his head. "No one's come forward, saw anything." Wonder who the boy was playing with. We found 14 kids in the morning since we started looking. Kids playing, fishing, no one saw the boy. The egret's beak dunks in the water and comes out with a wiggly fish. Points its beak to the sky and swallows the fish. "Still no call to the house," I tell him, then tell him about Leontine Gallup. Don't have to tell him about the hose man Francona took Rachel's statement last night. "Thought I'd check out this Leontine fellow, but don't want to get in your way. He's a big guy," I say. "Probably has large hands." Frenchie calls over a detective I'd never seen before, introduces Eddie Vega. "This is Lucian Kay. Go with him. He'll tell you what it's about." Eddie's dark-complected, with jet-black hair and brown eyes, classic Latin look. "To me," Frenchie says, "remember, you're just a private eye. Eddie here might be a rookie dick, but he's the real police. Capiche?" We take my DeSoto. "What kind of aftershave is that?" I ask. "Chanel for men. It's Parisian." "Really?" I have to keep from snickering. "Better than an aqua velvet junk you're wearing." Hard to argue with that. "I do need a new aftershave. Maybe I should go Parisian." The only Gallup listed in the phone book is Albadalon Gallup, and an address turns out to be a single-story brick house with a green tile roof at the corner of Bell and Hagen Avenue, a block from Bayou St. John. A tall woman with long red hair streaked with gray answers the doorbell. Her green eyes move from me to Eddie, who holds up his credentials, with gold star and crescent badge attached. "Is he okay?" she asks. "Who?" "My brother, Leontine. He's not supposed to ride on the engine. He didn't get hurt, did he?" I shrug. "I'd like to speak with him. Is he here?" "Oh, no, no. He's at the fire station." She takes in a deep breath, lets it out, and smiles at me. A pretty woman in her 40s. A hand on her hip now. She wears a lightweight, gauzy, pale orange dress and slippers. Tells us she's Maya Jane Gallup, the only woman teacher at St. Aloysius High School. Explains how her younger brother is at the fire station on Carrollton by Claiborne Avenue. Their uncle is a fire captain. Been there since Saturday morning. Lenny's not cut out to be a banker. Too high strung. He's going to be a fireman. I'll give her my card, ask for a phone number in case we needed to call back. We start to step away and I ask, "Who's Al Baldalon?" Her eyes go wide. "Our father. He died 2 years ago." Got her phone number to call her later. Put the Lucian K. Tomcat moves on an older woman. Eddie yawns as we head to the fire station on Carrollton. "Why are you thinking about my love life instead of the murder?" "I am thinking about the murder. But I've never hung out with a professional Tomcat before." "You've been listening too much to Frenchie." When he rolls off the names of two of my ex-girlfriends, I shut up. By the time we get back to City Park, I have a headache. What I get for telling Frenchie about the women in my life. Eddie asks me more questions than we asked Leontine Gallup. I wave Eddie to Frenchie to explain Leontine Gallup arrived at the New Orleans Fire Department Carrollton Station before 6 a.m. Saturday and is still there. 12 firemen confirmed this, including two captains. And he has small hands, I add. I have to tell Sam this. A black cat with a head looks like a small football sits atop the brick wall of Cabrini Playground across the street from my building. A tomcat. It lets out a low howl, then another. I slip through the French doors out on my balcony and throw a piece of ham from my second ham sandwich down to the banquette. We call sidewalks banquettes. It's not until the third piece hits the wall and falls as the cat notices and jumps down and eats all three pieces. He licks a paw, then the tomcat up on this balcony goes back in, sits in his easy chair, and closes his eyes to bring images of a couple girlfriends to mind. Only I see the dark water of the lagoon. I see a small blonde boy curled in a burlap sack. At least bodyguard and Sam's son will keep me involved in the case. We got to catch this bastard. My doorbell rings, and I see it's after 10. I hit the buzzer, go out on the landing to see Frenchie trailing smoke up the stairs. I leave my apartment door and go to the refrigerator. He steps in and says, "Hit me." I pop open two chilled Falstaffs and bring him one, and he plops on my sofa, and I go back to the easy chair. "Got two confessions tonight." Frenchie takes a hit of Falstaff. "Neither got the location of the body right. Both said the boy drowned." I mentioned the Merthins and being in Bay St. Louis. "Damn, I want to get both fathers in to see if there's a common denominator with the boys beyond the park and school. We keep canvassing, hoping to find someone or something out there." I tell him I have a phone number to Bay St. Louis. He shrugs. "After the funeral, I guess." I explain Sam will be back tomorrow. Frenchie pulls a photo from his coat pocket. A little blonde-haired boy, Eddie Amable, in a khaki suit, standard Catholic school uniform. Frenchie puts it on the coffee table. "I know you won't stop snooping around." He's quiet now, and I wait for it. He takes a long swig before he says, "When it's a child, it's so much worse." I nod. "I used to be an altar boy," Frenchie's voice comes low. "I remember believing in, well, believing. I don't think there's a cop in the world who believes anymore." We both take swigs. "I stopped believing at Anzio, maybe earlier, Sicily. The big guy should give us a break. If he's all powerful and knows all, if he just stopped the murdering, snap a finger." We drink more. Someone leans in a corner outside. Someone else starts playing a piano. Frenchie closes his eyes and snaps them open. I get us fresh beers. He looks at me as I give him his. I close my eyes and see the autopsy of that little boy. Frenchie Cop DeVille has witnessed hundreds of post-mortem exams. I've seen too many myself. My eyes focus on his little fingers that'll never play with toys again. A bird starts up outside, bird running through a litany of calls. Has to be a mockingbird. I told Francona, when we catch the bastard, he'll have to interview him. If I have to, I'll kick his lungs out. After Frenchie leaves, I go back out on the balcony. No cat, no mockingbird, no piano. How'd he put it? When we catch the bastard. I have no doubt in my tiny, half-French, half-Spanish mind, we will catch the bastard. Up so early, I catch the milkman as he places the bottles outside the building's front door. I tell him hello, pick up my bottle of cream and a larger bottle of milk, grab one of the morning papers stacked outside for us tenants, and go into my office. I fix a pot of coffee and chicory on the stove in the kitchen portion of my office, pour a heaping dollop of cream into the strong coffee, mix in 2 sugars, and bring it to my desk. Monday, September 20, 1948. The New Orleans Eagle headline reads, "Hurricane slams into Florida." Story runs beneath a large photo of waves slapping palm trees. This storm is the most intense to hit the U.S. mainland since the 1935 Labor Day hurricane, which missed New Orleans like the one this year as it heads across Florida and Atlantic. Last year's storm, now called the Fort Lauderdale Hurricane as it blew over Florida into the Gulf of Mexico, hit New Orleans directly, the eye passing over the Central Business District. The first major storm to do that since 1915. The lakefront flooded, most of Jefferson Parish went under, including Moisan Airport. 2 photos dominate the bottom of page 1. Francona and a uniform officer next to the lagoon, and a picture of the brick bathroom set off by nearby low-hanging branches of a huge live oak. The article lies sandwiched between the photos. Police search for clues in child murder. No leads, no witnesses. Police and the little boy's family call out to anyone who saw anything. The reporter managed to get the name of Eddie's school wrong, St. Anthony of Padua on Canal Street. Or maybe Mr. Amable or Frenchie gave the reporter the wrong information on purpose. Never give the media everything you know. You would think the last place I'd find little boys playing Monday morning would be City Park. Nope. I find 7. 3 pairs and 1 fishing alone in the lagoon. He won't tell me his name because his mother told him not to talk to strangers. I show him the picture of Eddie Amable and the boy shrugs. I peek in his bucket, see 3 small catfish. 2 boys on a swing talk to me but have never seen Eddie. They hadn't been in the park for a few weeks. Why aren't you in school? They go to Holy Rosary and no school today. Somebody died, said one kid. Got hit by a truck. No, he drowned. One kid thought he recognized Eddie Amable's picture, but wasn't sure. None had been in the park over the weekend. The other pair, boys around 9, say they come to the park every day when they cut class. Public school kids. Won't tell me which school. Both look like they're ready to run if I get any closer. They don't recognize Eddie's picture. Yes, they were in the park Saturday, and the police talked to them yesterday. See any strangers around the park? Just you. The taller one slaps the younger one on the head, and they give me a quick 3 Stooges routine of slapping and yuck, 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 before the taller one says, "A man asked us if we wanted a puppy one time." "When?" They shrug. "Around Christmas, it was cold." "What did he look like?" "He's dead." "How do you know?" "They tell me the man was a hobo, lived by the railroad tracks. I told my daddy about him and the puppy. Daddy looked for him. He saw cops on the railroad tracks, and the hobo got hit by a train." I turned to look up toward the lake where the railroad ran. Never saw a train go over 5 miles an hour along there. I write a note to check with Frenchie on that story. The last pair of boys see me approach and scramble down an oak branch, so massive, 2 thick branches lie on the ground. They run away before I get close and split up. These guys could teach criminals how to get away. When I get back to my car, 2 patrol cars are checking it out. Young guys, looking bored. 1 recognizes me. Names are Treen and Romer. They are canvassing as well. We got detectives around, too. I ask about the hobo and the railroad train. Treen was there just before Christmas. Bum got his foot caught in the rails. Conductor tried to stop. Treen yawns. He did have 2 puppies in a box. My sister took 1, and the conductor took the other. After a shrimp po' boy and steak fries at Chico's Sandwich Shop on Esplanade, I go back to the park. 2 boys sit next to another of our second-place statues, the one of General Beauregard on a stallion at the park entrance. They have magnifying glasses and are burning ants to death. Holy Rosary kids again. Both recognize Eddie. "He's the one that died?" I ask if they were in the park over the weekend. "No." "Seen any strangers in the area?" "No, just me." I walk over to Bayou St. John, take a right, and move along smooth, dark brown water. The bayou runs from Lake Pontchartrain down this way, takes a dog leg to the left from the park to run along Moore Street before it dead ends at Jeff Davis Parkway, another tribute to the Confederacy. Got a second-place statue there as well. Old Jeff Davis with arm extended, hand raised. A bell rings at Cabrini High School across the bayou, and girls hustle in and out of the main building in their white blouses and dark blue skirts, white and black Oxford shoes. I watch as the hurrying ends, quickly followed by another bell. Holy Rosary Grammar School lies next door and looks locked up. Two black boys sit fishing with cane poles under the pedestrian bridge that crosses the bayou. They pretend they don't see me as I step up and ask if they're catching anything. They look around 7 or 8. "Couple perch," says the older boy. I ask if I can show them a picture. They both look at me. Kids in gray t-shirts, baggy jeans, both with well-worn tennis shoes. I show them the picture, ask about Eddie, ask about strangers. "You police?" "I'm a detective. Police talked to us yesterday." A squeal across the bayou draws our attention as a little girl raises her cane pole, bent nearly in half, stands and backs away from the bayou. She pulls a large fish from the water and keeps walking backward, the fish flopping on the grass now. "Ellie's got another one." I take the boys across the bridge, arrive as Ellie, around 10 years old with short reddish-brown hair and mahogany skin, shows her fish to a smaller boy with her. Got to be her little brother with the same complexion and hair, same wide-set eyes and high forehead. She wears a dark brown dress, and the boy wears a brown t-shirt and baggy trousers. Ellie sees me and freezes. I stop just as I get off the bridge. "I'm a detective. Can I talk to you all a minute?" Never known a black kid who wasn't wary of a white man. Both look down. The big fish dangles from the little girl's fingers. "What kind of fish is that?" Ellie looks at me, doesn't meet my eyes exactly, but looks at my face. "Sakale." She has trouble holding it, and the big fish drops to the grass. She grabs it with both hands. "Bring me the bucket." The boy brings her a bucket, and she puts the fish inside and pulls the bucket further from the water. Ellie carefully works the hook from the fish's mouth as I step up. "That's got to be 5-6 pounds. Is it good to eat?" "Yes, sir. Sakale is delicious. I'll give you $1 for it." The two look at me with open mouths. "I don't know how to fish," I tell them, as I pull out my wallet, withdraw a crisp dollar bill and a business card. They look at each other, and I hear the boys from across the bayou on the bridge now. Ellie puts her pole aside, making sure the line isn't tangled. She looks down at her catch, looks at her brother, then looks at me. Her hand extends, and I put the dollar and my card in it. "Show your mama my card and tell her how you earned the dollar." I reach into the bucket and pull out the fish. Gotta be 6 pounds. A wide-bodied silverfish with black dots on it. I look at the little boy. Ellie stares at her fish like a kid who just lost a Christmas present. It's a pretty fish, silver scales catching the sunlight. "How do I cook it?" Ellie wipes her hands on her dress. "You scrape off the scales, clean out the insides, cut off the head and tail, and fry it." I have to scrape off the scales. I put the fish back in the bucket. "Keep your fish." Ellie slowly moves the dollar behind her back. I chuckle. "Keep the buck." I wipe my hands on my suit pants. This dark brown suit's due for the cleaners. I pull out Eddie's picture. Neither has seen him. I ask about strangers. Only police. I ask them to ask other kids. Tell them I'll be back around. I thank them and walk across Moss Street to the rear gate of Holy Rosary. I glance back, and all the kids are looking at the dollar bill. I look back at the convent and the rectory on the left, small playground to the right, with a two-story school building and a large domed church which faces Esplanade Avenue. Francona comes out of the rectory, sees me, and steps over. "Anything?" He shakes his head. "You still canvassing the park?" "Yep, spoke to some kids," and out over my shoulder, "these two." "Wait, kids in the park today?" "I guess the parents don't like them." "Jesus." I head back to my car, thinking my theory that kids see everything doesn't work all the time. They didn't see this crime. I talked to Sam that evening on the phone. No additional phone call came, and he still wants me to keep checking around the park. A rainy Tuesday and no one's in the park. So I work on the two skip trace cases I've been neglecting. I start looking for a witness needed for a trial this coming Monday. Witness saw a crane operator drinking a beer, dropped the beer, reached for the beer, and let the crane swing, which knocked the man off a 5-story scaffold. Witness was so distraught when the managers didn't seem upset, he scooped up the beer can. I had it dusted for fingerprints later, and the crane driver's prints were all over it. I start with my contact at the phone company, then the gas company, then the electric company, and find the missing witness at his new digs, 3 blocks from his old digs in Metairie. After a quick trip to the Lower Garden District on another case, I'm back home before dark and it's still drizzling. In my office, I open the file of my second skip trace case and call Professor Alan Q. Fry, who answers after the first ring. "It's your private eye," I tell him. "You have a pen handy?" "You found her?" "She's living with a sister in Gulfport."
"Mississippi?"
"No, Alaska." "Yes, sir. I have her address and phone number. Can you copy?"
"Yes, yes, yes." I hear fumbling noises before he comes back with, "Go ahead."
I'll give him an address on Pass Road and a phone number.
"Oh, my God, can't believe you found her."
"That's what you paid me to do."
"I know, I know. Do I owe you any more, Mr. K?"
"No, sir. The retainer covered it."
"You sure this is her?"
"Her lifelong best friend says so."
"Okay, okay. Thank you. Thank you so much."
He hangs up and I hang up, kick up my feet and my desk. Just made a 60-year-old widowed professor sound like a schoolboy again. I found his old sweetheart. It took less than an hour, knocking on doors in the rain in the Lower Garden District, till I found someone who had lived there long enough to remember Julie Monroe, who grew up on Thalia Street. Got that information from old City Park directories at the library. I was lucky. Found Julie's best friend still living on Thalia Street. I fixed 2 fried bologna sandwiches with melted cheese and mayonnaise, opened a bag of potato chips, washed it all down with icy root beer, put a nice blue station on the radio. French doors cracked open since the rain stopped, a cool, damp breeze flowing through the apartment. CBS is in the middle of a radio play, a murder mystery set in an English castle, when my doorbell rings right after 8 p.m., and I let Frenchie in, handing him a cold Falstaff. 2 promising leads, he shakes his head. Turned bad. Zippo. We got nothing. He takes a hit of Falstaff, says Francona told him I'm still working the park. Yeah. Good. We have the neighborhood. Getting complaints. Can you believe it? We're scaring the children. Good. Let them be scared. Damn rich people don't like cops knocking on their doors. Think I'll get a couple black cops to come along with us tomorrow. Knock on Whitey's door. Ellie crosses the pedestrian bridge, struggling to carry her bucket, balancing her cane pole over her shoulder. It's almost 4 p.m. Wednesday, and my feet are tired. City Park runs from City Park Avenue all the way up to within a mile or so from Lake Pontchartrain. Up to Robert E. Lee Boulevard. Yep. Another nod to the Confederacy. Still can't figure out all these second-place statues. Who brags that they lost the war? Hell, New Orleans was only a Confederate city for the first year of the war. Damn Yankees captured it early. Saved it from burning like Atlanta. Need some help? Ellie stops, recognizes me, and smiles. No, I'll go right over there, she points toward Holy Rosary. I peek in her bucket, see another sacalay, not as big, and 2 catfish with yellow bellies. One has to be 5 pounds. I can't sell these to you. My mama loves catfish. She moves past me, and I see a stocky black woman in a white maid's outfit standing at the rectory gate. I follow Ellie across Moss Street. The woman opens the gate, and Ellie shows her what's in the bucket. She pats Ellie on the head, then looks me hard in the eyes. You the detective? Yes, ma'am. I came back to ask Ellie something. I'm Ellie's mama. I'm the maid here at the rectory. Thought you asked all your questions. I thought of another. I looked down at Ellie. She's in a blue dress today, your hair in braids. Has anyone who used to come around not been around in the last few days? Ellie looks at her mama, then shrugs at me. Mama says, Toby. He ain't been around the last week or so. Mama nods to the rectory. I keep an eye on my children. Oh, yeah, Ellie says. Sacalay man. Mama looks into my eyes again. Boy, I got a job not long ago, but he still hangs with the children too much for my liking. Full-grown man hanging around with little children. I take out my notebook and pen, ask if they know his name. His last name. No. Where he lives? No. If he's got a car? No. I write down the description Mama gives me. White boy, early 20s, couple inches shorter than my 5'6". Stocky, short brown hair, light brown. Ellie pulls a sacalay from her bucket. We called him Sacalay Man, she points the fish. He got dots on his face, Ellie adds. Dots? Freckles, says Mama. Big ones and little ones. She starts to back away and Ellie picks up the bucket. When was the last time y'all saw him? Ellie shrugs.
He got a job. Where? Can Company. She points down the bayou. Son of a gun, I remember the American Can Company sits on the bayou just around the bend. Ellie takes her bucket to the rectory, but Mama isn't finished. Something about that boy, something in his eyes, something dark. She leans close and looks into my eyes. You got a kind heart, mister. It's there in your eyes. Especially the way you look at my little girl. You couldn't hurt a child if your life depended on it. I'm about to tell her my heart wasn't so kind to the Nazis in North Africa, Sicily, Italy. I was an Army Ranger back then. Another lifetime of stark terror. And as I step away, I remember little Eddie Amable, whose short life ended in terror. And I'm going to do something about it. The American Can Company is a complex of six red and white buildings rising three stories on Bayou St. John. I pull into the Gulf Oil Station across Orleans Avenue from the plant entrance, drop a nickel at the payphone, and dial the Merthin's residence. Get Rachel on the phone. The man who drank from your hose, I began. You said he had a pockmarked face. Did you mean like acne or more like large freckles? Dots, like freckles. I thank her and hang up. Dots on his face. Sackalay man. Toby. I pull into the parking lot of the Can Company. Have to park in back next to four huge trash bins. I get out and go over to the nearest bin. Spot a burlap sack immediately. Pull it out. It has lemons stenciled on it. The goosebumps are back. I fold the sack and head to the main building. I'm intercepted by a middle-aged man in green overalls. He switches a clipboard from one hand to another as he steps up.
Something I can help you with?
I hold up the burlap sack. Y'all can oranges here, lemons? He shakes his head.
We manufacture tin cans, mister. Those sacks came from our mess hall. We feed the workers so they don't have to bring their lunches. Who are you?
I pull out a business card and he looks at it and chuckles. I get that reaction sometimes.
I'm Elliot Barcelona, a foreman.
I'm looking for a man named Toby. Been working here a short while, freckle-faced guy in his early 20s.
Elliot leads me to the main building that smells faintly of wintergreen.
We move down a hall of polished linoleum to a door marked Personnel Department. He passes my card to a tall woman with dark brown hair, looks to be around 40. She wears the dress the same green color as the overalls Elliot wears. He steps out of the office. Behind the high counter, the woman gives her name as Doris. She examines my card carefully, turns it over. What can I do for you, Mr. Private Investigator? I'll give her Toby's script, and she nods. He's been here a month, but hasn't been here this week. Doesn't bode well for him. Can I get his name and address? If you were a real cop. I nod to the phone on the nearest desk. I can get one here in a few minutes. She narrows her left eye, goes to the desk, and brings the phone to me. It has one of those 20-foot cords, and I call the detective bureau immediately. Frenchie's not in, neither is Francona. Can you get either on the radio? Have them call me at this number? I'll point to the phone, and Doris gives me GA-3470 extension 2. I pass along the number, hang up. Doris keeps staring at me. You're what I'd expect the PI to look like. I am? Tall, dark, and handsome. Better looking than Bogart. The phone rings, and she answers, passes it to me. Frenchie goes, what you got? A good lead. I'm serious. Better be good. I'll be there shortly. Where are you? Doris stays by the counter. Women throw themselves at you all the time? Yes, ma'am. Had to peel one off my windshield this morning. It's sad. She finally breaks into a smile and asks if I'd like a cup of coffee. She brings one for herself as well, whispers. She has to stay with me, which gets her away from her desk. Didn't realize PIs and cops were so cozy. The lieutenant's coming, I say, is my uncle. I'm halfway through the weak coffee when Frenchie trails smoke in, cigarette dangling from the side of his mouth. I introduce Doris, and he shows his badge, and she asks, you really his uncle? Frenchie closes his eyes for 4 seconds, opens them and says, sure, why not? Doris glares at me, then shakes her head. We leave with the address and phone number of Tobolio A. Prida. No wonder he calls himself Toby. Francona leans against their black prop car next to the rear door of the building. I run down the information on Toby to both as Frenchie fires up a lucky strike. Enough for a search warrant, I ask? Maybe. We got to play this the right way, goes Frenchie. Duty judges Wickersham. He'll sign anything I put in front of him. He tells Francona to do a flyby of Toby's place to get scripts, description of the house, and any vehicle information for search warrants. Take me to the bureau, Frenchie tells me. You can type out the warrants for me. The sun is gone by the time we pull up in front of Toby's place. 4 prowl cars, 2 unmarked, join the unmarked car Francona sits in along North-South Cedo Street, a half mile from Bayou St. John and City Park. I park my DeSoto behind the last car, watch the cops move to the house with military precision. 2 uniforms going around back, 2 up the front steps to spread out on a small porch of the white, one-story raised house. Francona and Frenchie moving to either side of the front door. I stay out by the front gate of the white picket fence with Detective Eddie Vega and a crime lab man. A rusty Ford pickup stands parked in the driveway. Rust. The sack with the body had rust on it. The front door is opened by a young man in soiled undershirt and blue pajama pants. I see the dots on his face from the gate. He takes a step back and Frenchie shoves him inside. Goes in with Francona right behind. Vega counts loud to 10 and leads us up the front 4 steps to the house. Toby sits on a green sofa while Francona stands on the side of the coffee table. Toby's crying. Vega heads into the house to find Frenchie, who's already searching. Toby's light brown hair is crew cut. Different sized brown freckles speckle his face, neck, and arms. He holds his hands up. Big hands. Francona pulls the coffee table away from the sofa and sits on it, knees almost touching Toby's knees. Francona takes the man's right hand like he's shaking it, holds it. You know why we're here, don't you? The crying lessens, and Toby wipes his eyes. What happened that would bring detectives to your house, Toby? He shakes his head and cries louder again. Francona waits. Io italiano, Tobolio, Francona says. Like you. You need to tell me paisano. Frenchie calls out from the kitchen. Luce, get in here. I step through a hall into a bright kitchen with a small turquoise table and 4 matching chairs, a matching turquoise counter with a single sink, dark wooden cabinets, a white refrigerator, and stove. Frenchie points to a wall-mounted phone. Numbers on the wall in pencil. Any familiar? I look, almost miss it. I point to the 5th of the 7 numbers. That's the Merthin number. You sure? I called it a little while ago. Frenchie leads me back into the front room, waves for me to join Francona, calls out to his man. Ask him how the hell he has the Merthin phone number penciled on his wall. Toby looks at Frenchie, then at me as I approach, then at Francona, and pulls his left hand over his eyes and cries even louder. Frenchie growls at Francona, get him out of here. An hour later, Vega and I, sweeping the beams of our flashlight back and forth, spot the freshly dug-up area at the backyard. I get a shovel out of Toby's shed, dig up another burlap sack with oranges stenciled on it. Inside, we find a pair of U.S. Kids high-top tennis shoes, special red edition, kid size 4. As we wash our hands in the kitchen sink, Vega goes, wonder why he kept the shoes. Frenchie tells us murderers sometimes keep a souvenir of their killing. They don't usually bury them. Stash them in the attic or behind a baseboard. Frenchie announces we're finished here, tells me to go home. I don't get to go to the detective bureau, even if I found the killer. If they have to beat the confession out of Toby, no one wants witnesses, even an almost nephew of a lieutenant. It's nearly midnight when Frenchie comes by for a beer. His brown suit is as wrinkled as a petrified prune. He drops on the sofa, his feet up on my coffee table. I stretch out as much as I can in the easy chair. He begins. I listen to the confession just outside the door of the interview room. Almost had to handcuff myself to the nearest table so I wouldn't go in and throttle him. Francona's good. Didn't have to lay a hand on the bastard. He did the hardest thing we have to do in homicide. Make friends with the killer to get his confession. Nothing's better than a confession. He takes a hit of beer. But you know that. We both take swigs. Toby saw a blonde-haired boy crossing over from the park to the houses of the rich one day. Saw the boy again another day. Then saw him again. Followed the boy to a house. Merthin House. Heard a woman call out to the boy, Eddie, come on in now. He's the one who used the hose, talked to the same woman, told Francona he was scouting out the place. Another hit of beer. He didn't know there were 2 Eddies until Francona told him. Frenchie raised his beer to me. Your friend got lucky. Toby snatched the kid, but the kid gave him trouble. Got home, got the kid's shoes off to prove to the parents he had the kid, only the kid kept giving him trouble. He made the call, but the kid started wailing, so he strangled the little bastard. Panicked, dumped the body, went back home and got drunk. Realized he still had the shoes. He was going to throw them in Bayou St. John, but was worried someone would see him, worried they'd float, so he buried them. Frenchie's already finished his beer, I'll get him another. He claims he's been drinking ever since. Ran out of bourbon, ran out of gin, ran out of beer this morning. Frenchie takes a deep draft. We found empty bottles in his garage, just like he said. A deep breath is followed by, he did it to get money. Kidnapping. Didn't intend to kill the little boy. Frenchie takes another swig, closes his eyes. I gotta call Sam in the morning. Tell my old buddy from Holy Cross how his family dodged a bullet. Then I'll visit Ellie and her mama. Thank them. Tell them it was a close call. But Mama was right about the eyes. Sakale. I let it bounce softly off the ceiling. What, the fish? Kids who turn me on to Toby call him Sakale Man because of all the freckles. Frenchie's eyes are still closed. We called them calico bass when I was little, or speckled bass. Sakale is actually a crappie. Spelled crappy, but pronounced crappie. Frenchie's voice comes low. I keep hearing him say, I didn't mean to kill the little bastard. A minute of quiet before Frenchie adds, good work on this one, pretty baby. Only person who ever calls me that. Later I say, it was just gumshoe work. Leg work. Sometimes it's all leg work. But he knows that.
Sakale Man is copyrighted by O'Neill Deneux. Music for the podcast by Duke Ellington and his band is in the public domain and was obtained from the Internet Archive. Mixing and editing for the podcast were done by Ray Purdom and Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.elleryqueenmysterymagazine.com.